Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. It's Friday. We made it through the week. So this is our weekend podcast. We can kick back, look back at the week, look ahead, have reasonable conversations like we always do on Friday. So welcome back to our good friend, A.B. Stoddard. Thanks for coming back on the podcast, A.B.
It's great to be with you, Charlie. Happy Friday.
I mentioned to my wife that I was going to be doing the podcast with you, and she said, oh, that's fantastic. That's great. I love her.
Aww.
So we get positive feedback, which I don't always get. I mean, I get it around here, but
I hope you will tell your bride that I follow her on Twitter and I hang on her every dog tweet. So
okay, I will tell her that. I also share that with the dogs.
No, yeah, please,
because I think they kind of enjoy a little bit of social media celebrity. I don't know if they fully appreciate it, but we've actually had kind of an interesting run here because it's been very, very cold here in Wisconsin. So my wife actually went out and bought a few big bags of seed, and she put it out back in the woods. And we've had like this incredible menagerie. We had, I think we had 10 deer, including, you know, bucks with the racks and everything show up the other day. And then the turkeys came and
so cool.
And the turkeys kind of drove off the deer, and it was just like watching the deer. And it's you know, there are certain consolations for living in flyover country in the middle of nowhere. This
and
would be one
there of there certainly are, and I think that what your dogs might not know is that they have envious dog rivals on Twitter who are upset that they don't have the same view that Augie and I Eli know. And you Pete their, do, and the sunset on the water. It's certainly worth it.
This is impressive that you actually know their names. This may actually go to their heads.
Oh, no, okay, Charlie, I am a pathological dog lover. You need to know this about me.
All right, there's so much ground I want to cover today. I want to talk about the Supreme Court and the kerfuffle over that and the back and forth and how that's going to play out. Because it's Friday, I'm going to give myself a little bit of a break, and we're not going to talk about Sarah Palin going and dining out in New York. It's just, I just can't take it. You know, what a joke that is. But could we just start with Nikki Haley and what's happened to Nikki Haley? Because there's a phenomenon that I'm trying to put my finger on. You know, this is a very, very accomplished woman, former ambassador to the United Nations, governor of South Carolina, clearly has presidential ambitions, has broken with Trump at least like 5 minutes, now is trying to get back into the good graces of MAGA. And she goes on Guy Benson's radio show and to rip Joe Biden, that everything Joe Biden is doing is terrible. Joe Biden's the weakest president ever, you know, yada, 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 as opposed to, you know, the Churchillian Donald Trump. And about 14 minutes into the interview, because I listened to a lot of it, she had this to say. This is Nikki Haley suggesting the president and the vice president both resign.
That's the dangerous part of the next 3 years, is honestly, for the good of our country, if Biden loved our country, he would step down and take Kamala with him, because the foreign policy situation is beyond dangerous at this point.
Sabi, you want to tell her? You want to break it to her?
I mean, yeah, so she's being mocked on Twitter because she's putting Nancy Pelosi third in line for the presidency in the highest office of the land. And of course, she trusts her as commander in chief. You know, desperate times call for desperate measures. And Nikki Haley is a desperate woman. And I'm really happy for her that, you know, Heritage had her to be the Margaret Thatcher speaker. You know, she has these little corners of the universe where she's still quasi-respected. And they fantasize about the return of a normal Nikki Haley saving the party from itself or something. But the character that she has displayed since she left the Trump administration has demolished what character she showed while she was in the Trump administration. And of course, the peak of her integrity was when she was governor of South Carolina. It's been a steady decline. But the ugliness of her trying to back away from Trump after January 6, 2021, and then try to crawl back is so pathetic. And I just look back at, you know, the way we spoke about her, the way we wrote about her. I remember in 2017 when we were still talking about Donald Trump's long list of sexual assault allegations. Remember, he promised he was going to sue everyone once he was president and the campaign was over, whoever said, you know, who was lying about him. And she, you know, she's working in the administration and says women need to be heard. I mean, she was brave. She took on, you know, people who were sort of talking down to her in the administration, Larry Kudlow said she was confused at some point, and she stood up and said, no, I respectfully was not confused. She was like mounting this special lane for herself of like Tiger Lady politician that was going to like be Liz Cheney or something. And it's just so sad to listen to her. It is.
I mean, you mentioned the governorship, you know, when the way she handled the removal of the Confederate flag was a truly extraordinary moment. I mean, I can still remember, you know, the ceremony and the way that she finessed that. After January 6th, she sits down with Tim Alberta and says, we can never go that way again. And apparently, though, she sat, you know, by herself and decided which lane she wanted to be in. She says, no, I don't want to do the Liz Cheney thing. I'm going to do the J.D. Vance thing. Okay, this is where I'm trying to connect the dots, because there's this weird phenomenon. I don't know whether we should call it Haleyitis or whether we should call it Vancism or something. It's really smart people who really don't have any illusions about who Donald Trump is, and whose loyalty in the past has been in question, and therefore feel the need to be even more extreme in their sucking up-edness. You know what I'm saying here?
You've got to out-Trump the other Trumpkins because you have to pay a penance.
Right, because there's doubt. So therefore, I have to come up with the most over-the-top thing in order to show my allegiance. So in some ways, these folks who ought to be the best feel the need to be the absolute worst.
It's true. And again, it's they have to contort themselves. Look at Lindsey Graham. I mean, he kind of is like the poster boy for that, right? And it's really terrifying. You can just hear as she talks, Nikki Haley, that she knows that it's a matter of months before she gets canceled by Marjorie Taylor Greene. It's just so painful. She had what, like a 5-minute meeting at Mar-a-Lago after begging for months?
Begging.
You know, on the trail, to these lectures halls that she speaks to, that you know, the president, they're in contact, and that she went to Mar-a-Lago. That's what she needs to say. And what's it going to do to her? She has no lane, she has no constituency, but she can't swallow that.
So I know that we engage a lot in doom and gloom, but we should set aside a little time for some Schadenfreude, because one of the phenomena that you're describing there is the way in which all the knives are out over in MAGA land. And we've had, like, what, 6,000 Dems in disarray stories, all of which have been accurate. But there are some good MAGA in disarray stories as well. People trying to cancel one another. The story in Politico about what's going on in Tennessee is really quite something. where Trump endorses somebody who used to work for the State Department, and everybody else is like, whoa, wait, she's not pure crazy enough for us. And they're all beating up on, I mean, so... We're in this phase where Trump is sitting back trying to be the kingmaker, and a lot of the folks in his group are saying, no, you know, we're still completely MAGA, but you need to go with our brand of completely batshit crazy.
And that brand is Robbie Starbuck.
Robbie's the great, right?
Some goofball with a man bun whose real last name is Newsom, but his name is Robert Starbuck Newsom, and he decided to go by Robbie Starbuck and sport a man bun. And he is the MAGA frontiersman that Morgan Ortegas, who paid her dues, again, a former never Trumper, but, you know, crawled around crotch sniffing, as you might put it, Charlie, for many years on Fox, mm-hmm. and then working for Mike Pompeo. Embedding herself in MAGA so that she could have a run at a congressional seat one day. She probably has a very nice list of donors and backers, but Robbie is in her way, and people are mad at Donald Trump for rushing out to endorse her. You hate to see it.
Yeah, I hate to see it. So let me just read you the lead from the Politico story. So the headline is, Trump faces MAGA revolt over endorsement. Former President Donald Trump facing serious backlash from diehard loyalists over his decision to intervene in a Tennessee House race, with his supporters accusing him of spurning a staunch Republican ally who's running, which is Robbie Starbuck. Trump on Tuesday evening endorsed Morgan Ortegas, who served as a State Department spokesperson during his administration, blah, blah, blah. The announcement has caused a firestorm with far right high profile backers ranging from, and here are the new kingmakers, ranging from North Carolina Representative Madison Cawthorn to conservative activist Candace Owens, taking to social media to voice their support for Robbie Starbuck, a rival candidate who's been a mainstay of the pro-Trump movement. So you have the crackpot wing kind of flexing their muscles and saying no. I mean, think about this. Think about the world that we live in which Madison Cawthorn and Candace Owens are telling the former president, you're not nutty enough. No.
I know. They have on vaccines, and it's great. Like, it's just so amusing to imagine Trump, you know, having whoever it is, you know, Scavino scroll social media for him to make sure that, you know, he isn't being battered around on the booster shot or any of the other things he said by Candace Owens and her followers on her channel. It's pathetic.
It is. I don't want to spend a lot of time on Wisconsin, even though I live in Wisconsin and everything, but I could just give you a little brief, you know, thumbnail sketch of the Republican crack up here. I mean, it's really interesting. The Republicans are poised to do very well in Wisconsin. I mean, they should win here. It's an off-year election, kind of a weak Democratic incumbent, but they're stuck with Ron Anon at the top of the ticket in the Senate race. And now they're about to have a really nasty primary for governor. That's really bizarre. You have this guy named Kevin Nicholson, and he's, you know, again, it's not a unique thing. He's this really super ambitious guy who ran for Senate last time. He's never run for anything before. And this time around was running either for Senate or governor. He just wants to be something.
Yes.
He wants to be something in part because Richard Uihlein, the billionaire right-wing donor, has been bankrolling him, put $11 million into his Senate race last time, just $11 million. The guy got annihilated in the primary. Well, so Ron Johnson runs for reelection, and he figures, I'm going to run for governor because I want to be something. And so he's going to run against the establishment candidate, who's the former lieutenant governor, Rebecca Clayfish. And right out of the blocks, I mean, the story is Kevin Nicholson, who has referred to former Lieutenant Governor Rebecca Clayfish as dumb as a box of hammers or something like that. So we see where this is going, and he's going to be the insurgent candidate. The reason I'm bringing this up is because there's already kind of a crack up going on over how nutty you have to be about the 2020 election. All this pent up, angst and anxiety and people mad at each other and accusing each other of bad faith. So here's this guy, got $10 million in his back pocket from this right-wing donor. And he is going to run against the quote-unquote establishment, the electeds, the machine, which tells me that he's going to try to get to the right of the quote-unquote establishment candidate, which means I think there's a very good chance we're going to see an Ohio Senate race type race to the bottom. You know what I'm saying? Is now it's going to be, here you have the Republicans saying, hey, you know, maybe we can kind of finesse this. We can appease the crazies. You know, maybe we can grow this alligator in the bathtub, but maybe this time it won't grow and come out and bite us. And what do they got? They got a, you know, MAGA on MAGA primary fueled by all this money. And it is going to be just a glorious shit show here. Just telling you.
And that's what's so amusing about this is that if they couldn't go viral on social media and they couldn't find the money, but all they need is if they have some millions and they, you know, have an audience of crazies at the bottom that are willing to retweet them and send them $5 and you know, wear their caps. It's going to screw up the entire primary. There, as you said, we race to the bottom, and it is going to be like an Ohio scene where, you know, that the only person in Ohio, I guess Marino, the businessman, was sane on the Republican. I mean, excuse me, on the 2020 election, and thought that Biden had won. He's had to take that back and go like full big lie propagandist to try to compete with Josh Mandel and J.D. Vance.
Yeah.
And then you have Jane Timken, who was formerly the state party chair and formerly a normal Republican, having to run around and you know, trump herself up as much as possible, or she's not going to stand a chance.
Yeah. And this is the part of the problem is they do this in the primary. Who knows what it's going to be like in the electorate? Although who knows what this year is going to be like. So before we get into this, because I know you've written a couple of pieces that I want to preview. I want to get your take on Chuck Schumer. I want to get your take on the way the COVID derangement syndrome is working out. But before we do, let's spend a couple of moments talking about the big story of the week, the Supreme Court opening. Breyer finally retiring. Apparently, people pointed out to him, hey, you're 83. If you don't retire, it's going to be a Ruth Bader Ginsburg type thing again. And give me your take on the opening, the opportunity for Biden, and the way it's playing out. He doubled down yesterday, says, I am going to be naming a black woman to this seat, and they're probably going to try to fast track this. So give me your take of the state of play.
Okay, well, first of all, half of me, an arm and a leg, agrees with your posture on this promise to choose a black woman and then block out everyone, discriminate against all other comers. There's half of me that thinks that's wrong. The other half of me thinks if it's what it took for Biden to win the presidency, and it may well be, it may have literally clinched the South Carolina primary because Clyburn told him he had to promise that. Hmm. And then that clinched the nomination. And then it helped raise turnout for the election, both nominating a black woman to the vice presidency and promising to do so on the Supreme Court. First of all, I want everyone who missed it, they might have been busy with work or whatever, to just go back and spend a few minutes listening to Justice Breyer's remarks today.
Really good.
They were incredibly moving. And it really made me think, Charlie, about how we actually are really... It's really to our detriment that we don't get to hear from great minds on the Supreme Court, who normally, keep a very low profile. I'm not interested in Clarence Thomas these days since his wife became a 1/6 truther, but, these are really, really brilliant people, students of history and constitutionalists and passionate people who are great thinkers. And listening to Breyer reminded me that, maybe when they retire, they can just, take over like a cable news show, but they're really interesting people. And I thought that was incredibly,
I agree.
It was worth the time to listen to him. What I see, I liked Biden's, sort of, I'm going to take my time. Let's not answer questions today. But I think that you see overnight a panic in the party that maybe one of their elderly members could get sick. There could be an opening in the Senate and a 50-50 Senate. They don't have time to waste. They also don't have time to fight. We know that for a year, they've been working on this short list, and he probably knows who he wants, and he's not really doing the consideration now. They've done all this. They've prepped for this. And the truth is, the longer that you give the factions in the Democratic Party a chance to like line up between, oh, I want Jackson, I want Childs, I want this judge, I want that judge, and build rival constituencies for the different women, the more dissent you have in the party and the worse it is for Biden and the Democrats. So I'm kind of woke up this morning and decided, yeah, they need to do it like urgently, quickly.
I agree with you. Also, just a reminder, though, that it is a 50-50 Senate. And this is a party that has spent the last several months beating the bejabbers out of Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. You turn on certain cable shows and it's sort of like a Kyrsten Sinema, hate fest. And they're already talking about primarying her, even though she's not up till 2024. People, this is one of the reasons why when you have a razor thin majority, you don't burn your boats. You keep you understand what the math is. And the math is you don't have a majority without Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema and all this bullshit. Well, they may not vote for the president's nominee. They're going to vote for the president's nominee, I think, because they voted for all the other judgeships. But also keep in mind that if you didn't have those two in the Senate right now, Mitch McConnell would be the majority leader, and it would be irrelevant how they voted because there would never be a vote. There wouldn't be a committee hearing. He would do what he did with Merrick Garland. So kind of a reality check for those of you who've been doing it. Now, you said you half agreed with me on this identity politics thing. I guess, look, I want to make it clear. I think that the women that Joe Biden is looking at are immensely and impressively credentialed. I think, and I apologize in advance if I mispronounce the name, but the front runner judge, Ketanji, is that how you pronounce it? Mm-hmm. Brown Jackson. I mean, sterling, absolutely sterling. She's 51 years old. She has Ivy League credentials, the same kind of Ivy League credentials as sitting justices. She got her undergraduate and a law degree from Harvard. She was editor for the Harvard Law Review. She clerked for three federal judges, including Breyer. She would really follow the same track as Brett Kavanaugh, who also clerked for the justice that he ultimately replaced, like Kavanaugh and seven other current and former justices. Jackson would be coming directly from the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the second most important. I mean, and everybody that has worked with her and knows her says this is an outstanding judge on her credentials. So there's a right way and a wrong way of doing this. If President Biden had come out and said, I am naming Judge Jackson of the Supreme Court because I think that she is the best and most qualified candidate I have out there. And she is a Black woman and therefore also provides diversity for the court, which the court desperately needs. I think that would be outstanding. I think that you can be in favor of diversity and equality of opportunity. And I think it's a good thing to promote minorities like this, except that she is, her credentials are so sterling. She is so qualified. I think in some ways, the emphasis on the identity politics overshadows that. It's a disservice. So the right way to do it is to say, I'm going to choose the best person and there's going to be no, obviously, racial limitations. And then if you, decide that she is the best, you put her on the court. The wrong way is to say in advance, this seat is going to go to, X gender, X, because number one, it's reductive. It reduces them to their identity, their racial identity, as opposed to the fact that this woman has an amazing legal mind. On Twitter yesterday, I was debating this and also pointing out that the public hates this kind of over-racial preference, saying, Absolutely. We are only going to have, this position only goes to an Asian woman. This position only goes to a Black man. Overwhelmingly, the polls suggest that people don't like this. There was a constitutional amendment on the ballot in the state of California in 2020, repealing, basically saying, we're going to go back to, affirmative action, repealing the ban. This feels like a double negative, repealing the ban on racial preferences. And it went down overwhelmingly in freaking California. But discussing this, I kept coming back to William F. Buckley's comment that liberals claim they want to give a hearing to other views, but then are shocked and offended to discover that there are other views. And I can tell that a lot of folks just have never had a debate about, how to discuss equality of opportunity and diversity in a way that is, that actually upholds other principles of equality of opportunity and diversity. But anyway, that's my take. I think that I would love him to come out the Brooklyn Dodgers did not say we need a Black man to be second baseman. We're just going to find a Black man. No, they went out and they got Jackie Robinson because he was the best freaking player in baseball. And they proved that. I think that Judge Jackson is a superstar. And I think that there's a reductive quality to this process they're going through. But okay, so
I think this goes back to his promise. He can't unmake it. And so once he made it,
I got that.
Then the conversation, as you say, focuses instead on their incredible gifts and their resume on their race. And it's just that he made the promise and then now he can't break it.
Right. I don't think people should make promises like this, but that's my point. Okay. So speaking of the 50-50 Senate and the reality check about why maybe we shouldn't be spending so much time, needling and knifing Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. I know that you've been working on a piece on Chuck Schumer. I don't think Chuck's had his time in the barrel yet.
Yeah.
Because I don't fully understand. Please explain to me some of the strategies that they have been employing, including staging these fake sort of show votes that are destined to fail. So give me your take on Chuck Schumer.
So again, yes, he doesn't take any of the heat. That if you look at the family food fight that commenced at the end of the summer and basically continues to present day, where the Build Back Better social welfare agenda is on life support, it's always Pramila Jayapal or Joe Biden or Ron Klain or Joe Manchin or Bernie who takes the criticism from some wing of the party or gets yammered in the media, depending on where it is or on Twitter. It is never Chuck Schumer, who could have avoided so many of these mistakes with his impaired strategy or lack thereof. He knew from day one that the math is the math. We've discussed this a million times. He knew exactly what reality he was dealing with. I understand he was worried he'd be primaried for his own race this year from the left. And so he has become a social justice warrior and like pro-marijuana and everything else. That's fine in your own time. But given the math of the Senate, how could he possibly have taken a letter from Joe Manchin in July that stated Manchin's bottom lines and let a fight go on, an unrealistic expectation of Joe Manchin continue just to feed the left for a few more weeks and months and fuel a huge, huge fight that obviously is in the interest of progressives to extend when he knew the terms of that letter and he did not share it with Nancy Pelosi, who is basically the strongest asset the party has right now? And if you add to this the fact that, during which I think everyone should know, he meets in a small leadership, he has all these leadership teams and he's in touch with people, he's always on the phone and he's very communicative, but he has a meeting weekly with Warren and Sanders and Warner and Manchin. Bernie and Joe are at the table together all the time. And when they have their fake public fights, that's fine. But Schumer should have been thinking and been involved in how far these things go and serve the party or the different constituency or the fundraisers. And then at what point are they counterproductive and you get diminishing returns? I think it's ridiculous that he throughout the fall kept saying, oh, we're going to do Build Back Better. We're going to vote for it in the next 2 weeks. He's always promising a vote. It was going to fail. He puts the filibuster vote up, knowing that he's not going to succeed to, quote, put everyone on the record. He targets more progressive ire in that vote at both Manchin and Sinema. But he is, you know, out there speaking to Politico or whatever, saying, you know what? I have 48 senators now. Everyone's changed their mind. And he wanted to be on the record, Charlie, showing that 48 senators supported a filibuster carve-out. That's great. But, you know, for Senator Cortez Masto in Nevada, who's the most vulnerable Democratic senator in the cycle this year, it's not good to take a filibuster carve-out vote and get nothing for it in return. Yeah. So I want to mention one more thing. Because I've really been involved in a lot of bipartisan efforts and really close up with a lot of bipartisan cooperation and negotiation between different members of the Senate and the House over my many years of covering Congress. The idea that he would pick a fight with Susan Collins because he wanted, you know, her to lose, and she surprised everyone and won by 8 points in Maine when Biden won the state. All the polls the entire year showed her behind.
Yeah.
Schumer never apologized to her. He never met with her. And she doesn't often go crap on other members in the media. And she was so stunned that she was saying things like, I don't understand why he wants to go into this cycle, you know, in a 50-50 Senate, having marginalized the most bipartisan member. And it's true. It's absolute craziness to do that. All he had to do was privately have coffee with her. He didn't have to go out in front of the cameras.
So why is he doing these things? Why did he make these decisions? Is it all about that he's looking over his shoulder and he's afraid of a primary from AOC? Is that the through line on some of these decisions, which, as you lay them out, just don't make any sense?
I mean, is it a combination of being dumb plus fearing a primary, or is it just feeling the primary? No. I mean, sometimes you just look at, it's like you look at Mark Meadows, who writes a book full of reveals about his time in the Trump White House and then tells the 1-6 committee he can't discuss those reveals that are already in a book. I mean, I'm sorry, you know, does that make you dumb? Schumer is just, I don't think he's a great leader, and you don't cross Nancy Pelosi. That's rule number one.
So where are we at on Build Back Better? It seems to me like Manchin's just in an extremely bad mood. They've managed to burn some bridges to him. And this went from, we're negotiating, here's my number on the table, to, yeah, I'll get back to you.
Yeah. So it is currently not on the table. There are no negotiations. Manchin's not at the table. Everyone is conceding privately that whatever happens is going to be a Manchin written, drafted bill, and that they'll call a win and they'll move on. That would be the best thing for the party. And I've been advocating that for months. But I don't even know if he's at the table, because he's recently said, well, I think we need to see how we deal with our problems with things like inflation and the debt, he said, which means, Charlie, this will not take place during our lifetimes.
Now, they've been talking about breaking it up. We're talking about a reconciliation bill. Correct me if I'm wrong on any of this. They get one shot at this. So there's one vote. So they're obviously not going to squander that. So something will pass through reconciliation. But when they talk about breaking the bill up, that's not going to happen. I mean, they can break it up, but you only get the one shot. They're not going to get eight shots. They're not going to get six shots at passing all of this. So this is another one of these performative maneuvers rather than something that is designed to get something passed and signed, correct?
Exactly. And so knowing that Manchin has been blunt behind closed doors with the leadership and the president and his entire team all along, are you going to actually try to salvage a win, or are you which is a Manchin bill, and it's going to make everybody upset, but you get whatever, you know, you get what he gives you and you call it a win, or are you going to have more show votes? And I think time will tell. I don't know that Chuck Schumer thinks he's made any mistakes in it. Their playbook reported this week, or God forgive me if it was Punch Bowl. That Senate Democrats are really upset with him. The animosity towards Manchin and Sinema is not good, especially now that Breyer's retired. As you mentioned, they have supported all these lower court justices that Biden's nominated, 75% of whom are women and 65% of whom are non-white. Mm-hmm. They've played ball on the ARP, on all these things. And the Senate Democratic, the team is mad at Schumer. But I don't get a sense that we're going to see a course correction from him.
All right, so let's move on. I know that you're working on a piece for us, for The Bulwark, on COVID derangement syndrome. I want to get a sense of where we're at now, because it does seem as if, even though the numbers are, you know, continue to tick up in terms of the Omicron variant, that Americans are just done with this, that they're done with mask mandates, they are done even with vaccine mandates, and that the politics have changed. So talk to me about right now where we're at on the politics of COVID derangement syndrome.
COVID derangement is a winner for Republicans. And as sick as we think that is,
wonderful.
Basically, if you look past the dead family, friends, and, voters.
Other than the dead people.
Right. I mean, to them, it's a casualty in a culture war that either helps them sustain power or gain power. If you are blocking a fire truck from a burning house, you are pro-fire. And so the idea that you would still be blocking all these things, allowing the Delta variant to become the Omicron variant, means that you are pro-infection. The virus replicates and mutates. New variants jolt the economy, and Americans blame President Joe Biden. And it's insane and sick, but it's working for them. They're poised to take over the House and Senate. We don't see that swing voters are punishing the Republicans for their COVID derangement. And despite the fact that it's completely grim and surreal and depraved, it is a political winner. In MAGA world, you climb the power structure by, just like we were talking about before, about sort of out-trumping.
Right.
The number one litmus threshold is the big lie propaganda. How much, you know, are you willing to trumpet it in every appearance that you have? How many tweets a month are you talking about it? But the second thing is COVID radicalism. You must be a radical on COVID and try to one-up each other by hiding state data, spreading conspiracy theories, and basically spreading the disease. I mean, that's, I'm sorry, it's dramatic, but I think it's time we admitted it.
And so, I mean, that's obviously Ron DeSantis's strategy, that he's, you know, even more anti-vaccine than, considering that now Trump is endorsing the vaccine. But your point is that besides the death count, it's not hurting them. So that doesn't appear to be registering. I mean, I was flashing back the other day, thinking about when we hit 100,000 deaths. Remember, one of the newspapers just ran like a full page with all the names. And of course, it was only a fraction of them. And we just marked that as this amazing, tragic milestone. We're now still losing 2,000 people a day. and we're heading toward 1 million Americans dead from COVID. And I don't see any indication that you're wrong about this, that the voters are just like, we're just done. You know, take the masks off. We don't need the masks. We're all going to go out to dinner together. And the vaccine mandate. Now, when I say that, clearly, you know, the health professionals are still, you know, pushing this, saying, no, this is ridiculous. This is reckless. But it's a reminder that people have limited attention spans, or just they can make sacrifices for just so long, and then they're over.
Well, yeah, I see that there's burnout, but the vaccinated are vaccinated, so they're not stuffing up the hospitals, which is a responsible posture. We are living with the consequences of the unvaccinated impairing to the breaking point in some areas our healthcare system, and spreading a virus which replicates and then mutates and creates new variants. A future one could actually evade our vaccine protection. So this is beyond reckless. I mean, we've never seen anything like this. They never lament the death toll, Charlie. Do you see any have you ever seen a tweet from a Republican leader or office holder lamenting the death toll?
Well, see, this is no, I don't. But and I'm always thinking of the, you know, alternative scenarios here, because I think there was a period, and I certainly felt it, when as a vaccinated person, I was furious at the unvaccinated.
Yeah.
And yet there was no pushback from the Biden administration. I mean, yes, they pushed the vaccines. Yes, Joe Biden did say this is a pandemic of the unvaccinated, but that was never pushed. I never felt that they drew that line sharply enough about the vaccinated and the unvaccinated, and that if your life is still being impacted in a negative way, it is the unvaccinated, and really call out the people for engaging. I mean, I know the Democrats are not calling out this reckless rhetoric, and so they basically, the Republicans have had kind of a free field, haven't they?
This is exactly what I write in the piece.
Oh, okay.
That Biden hesitated and was spooked by people like Ron DeSantis. He was so spooked about the mandates, and he just decided from day one he wanted to combat the virus and not combat Republicans.
Great. So let's talk about Ukraine for just a moment here. Mm-hmm. We're seeing this very strange, bizarre, disturbing phenomenon of people on the far right who decided that they're going pro-Putin. I mean, you and I are old enough, yeah, to remember when conservatives were patriotic, when they sided with us before they would side with an aggressive, imperialistic Russia, including people who now call themselves America first, but are now apparently whatever Putin wants first. But that doesn't seem to be reflected in, and tell me whether I'm wrong about this, among Republicans in Congress. Is there a split in Republicans in Congress? It seems that there's some evidence that Republicans in Congress are pushing an even harder line on Ukraine. At the same time, Tucker Carlson is sucking up to Viktor Orban and Vladimir Putin. So where's the Republican Party on this?
Exactly. So this is a division that they would like to ignore, and they circle back to sort of a universal talking point that Biden's weak and his border's out of control and he's just so focused on the border of Ukraine, blah, blah, blah. But that's to avoid the fact that they're in disagreement. Mitch McConnell is a serious hawk on this issue, and people like Congressman Mike McCall and Mike Turner in the House are also serious hawks on this issue. I would recommend people watch the interview that Turner did with Tucker Carlson a few months back when he was defending the territorial integrity of Ukraine and the U.S. position, why we would care and why we're in alliance with them. We're in a transition. You know, I don't know that Mitch McConnell's mind will ever be changed. I don't think Mike McCall's going to go full MAGA and change his mind either, but What it's doing is forcing people who were formerly outspoken hawks to go quiet. So I know that Tom Cotton is trying to point out Biden's weakness, but is he standing up on Fox News Sunday this week and saying, we have to stand with the president, I wish he'd go further, it's wrong to back down from Putin? I mean, anyone who's seriously running for the nomination in 24 or 28 is just trying to clench their teeth and get through this.
There's no one, of course, who's going to say that we should send troops to Ukraine, either from the Democrats or the Republicans. But you know, you could certainly, I think there's legitimate criticism that the administration should get out in front of an invasion with the sanctions, that they should take a more aggressive stand about things like the Nord Stream 2, that they could take a more aggressive stand about all of this. But everything seems to be just covered in this, just, you know, this cloud of super tribalism. Yeah, and I'm trying to figure out, are we having a good faith debate? Where is the bipartisan unity? You know, saying to Vladimir Putin, do not underestimate this country. We may have divisions about X, Y, and Z, but we are not divided about this. That seems impossible now.
Well, I think, you know, there was a bipartisan senatorial delegation that went to Ukraine, and I think they're privately working behind closed doors with the administration on sanctions, and I'm heartened by that. Of course, they're keeping it quiet because they don't want to be in the crosshairs of, you know, I don't know, Ron Johnson or whoever the hell. But the point is that, yes, it is like everything else being poisoned by tribalism, and it's so unserious. You know, it's so dangerous and damaging for us and our national security posture. But I do think that the one thing that I heard yesterday that I found encouraging, because I agree with your criticism, mm-hmm. that we needed to see something more proactive and not, we'll wait and see, you know, if Putin acts and takes lives and then we'll sanction. I think that it was fascinating to hear yesterday Ned Price, the State Department spokesman, say that if Russia invades Ukraine, the Nord Stream 2 will not go forward. He said in one way or another. And he was asked about the Germans, and he said, if Russia invades, he repeated it, Nord Stream 2 will not go forward. And I thought that, now, that was yesterday.
Yeah, that's a big deal.
But it means that they're growing some teeth behind closed doors, and it might be a hopeful sign.
A.B. Stoddard, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast. We always appreciate it. We always enjoy it.
Thank you, Charlie. Great to be with you.
And thank you all for listening to this weekend's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back on Monday and do this all over again.